Okay, Google Maps is telling me I still have 5 miles to go on this rough gravel road.
Welcome to Shared State. I'm Nick Mott. This season, we're hearing stories of Montanans navigating political friction. And today, I'm here with reporter Shaylee Rager. Shaylee, where are you taking us?
I am taking you to a river valley in southwestern Montana.
All right, here we are.
And I ended up here last summer of 2021, when I was reporting on a historic drought that Montana and much of the West was experiencing.
I think I'm still a little scarred from last summer. I remember it well. Like, where I am, a lot of the rivers were closed to fishing part of the day because they were so low. It was so hot. I was just, like, sweating on my keyboard all day long. It was awful.
Yeah, Nick, I describe it as having a bit of a personal existential crisis. All these news reports telling us how bad conditions were, telling us how scary conditions were. And the question that I kept asking people was, how do we prepare for this in the future? Scientists are telling us this is going to happen more often. Is there a good model to show us how we can be more prepared? And people kept telling me you need to go to the Big Hole Valley.
Tell me more about the Big Hole.
Yeah, so it's in southwestern Montana. The Big Hole River, which is 152 miles long of blue ribbon fishing, runs through the Big Hole Valley. Its headwaters is in the Beaverhead Mountains, and it flows through to Twin Bridges. It's pretty undeveloped, remains pretty pristine, and there's still a lot of big ranches in the area. And I went to visit one specific rancher. His name's Dean Peterson.
Hi, are you Dean? How are you doing?
He runs a cattle operation with his brother on about 6,000 acres.
Yeah, this ranch sits 15 miles south of Wisdom, right between Wisdom and Jackson.
I wanted to talk to Dean specifically because his family has been in this area for a very long time.
I'm a fourth generation rancher. Hopefully my kids will be fifth.
So Dean has 3 sons, and he wants his kids to take over his ranching operation like he did from his dad. Dean was there working with his dad on the ranch in the Big Hole Valley in 1988, which was the last time Montana experienced drought like it had in 2021.
And it was a really dry year. Actually, a little more moisture than we had this year, but the river went dry at Wisdom.
So the Big Hole, this big 150-mile river, was dry there?
Right. There was a section of the river by Wisdom that for about a month in 1988 was just a dry riverbed. And this was a really big deal.
That kind of drought and like a river running dry seems like it'd be a huge deal anywhere it happened in Montana. But why was it a big deal in particular in the Big Hole?
To begin with, the city of Butte takes about 40% of its city water from the Big Hole River. Then there are outfitters and anglers. You know, they're taking people fly fishing. Their entire business model is based on the Big Hole River flowing. And then there are a lot of ranchers in this area who've been here for a long time who rely on the river to irrigate their land, to take care of their livestock and their crops. And like Dean Peterson described, water is essential to them.
The water is my lifeblood. That's what keeps me on the land. That's what keeps me raising cows. That's what keeps me from selling the ground.
The other reason I want to take you to the Big Hole is that since 1988, that really critical year, people there have been working to create a model to share the water. And I want to tell you the story about that. In this episode, we're talking about sharing when there's less to share. As climate change speeds up, can a model of shared sacrifice help us hold on to what resources we have left?
All right, Shaylee, take us back to 1988. What was going on?
The way that Dean tells it, tensions in the valley really came to a head that year.
The biggest issue was the river was dry and the ranchers were using all the water. You know, the fish were dying because there's no water in the river. And there's some conservationists in there that are saying, you know, this is wrong. You can't do this to a river.
It sounds like these different parties, like ranchers, fishermen, and the ecosystem, which is not really a party, like all had to suddenly confront this thing that they shared.
And all of these different people have really different interests that are pulling them in opposite directions. And one of those key stakeholders that people might not think about is a fish in the river, Arctic grayling.
What about a grayling is so key?
People who know a lot about Arctic grayling will tell you that they are not just any kind of fish.
They're really cool fish.
That's Jim Olson. He's a Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks biologist, actually the biologist for the Big Hole River.
Like a typical grayling on the Big Hole would be like 13 inches long.
They have, and he says Arctic grayling are one of his favorite types of fish.
The males in particular have a giant sail-like dorsal fin that's purple with spots on it. They have black slashes under their throat. They're a cool fish, very unique looking fish.
The other thing about Arctic grayling is that they need cold rivers and lakes to survive, and that's their breeding ground. And there are only two native populations of Arctic grayling in the lower 48, one in Michigan and one in Montana. But the population in Michigan went extinct in the 1930s. So Montana, the Big Hole River, is home to the last native population of Arctic grayling in the lower 48.
I'm no biologist, but I would venture to guess that a river running dry would have a pretty big impact on a fragile native fish like that.
Absolutely, and the federal government thought so too. A few years after that big drought, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was seriously considering protecting Arctic grayling under the Endangered Species Act to prevent them from going extinct. And that listing would mean that ranchers could be sued if their irrigation practices drain the river and hurt the fish. It would upend the way of life in the Big Hole.
It seems like it might have made people pretty mad.
That is absolutely right. Have you ever heard the saying, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting?
That's Mark Twain, right?
That's right, yeah. And this is where that sentiment comes into play. We're talking about the really complex system of water law in the Western United States.
It's a legally recognized right typically attached to a piece of land.
That's Michelle Bryan. She's a law professor at the University of Montana, and she literally just wrote the book on Montana water law.
It has characteristics that go along with it. It has an amount, and it has a priority date.
And that priority date means that water users with senior priority dates get to take a certain amount of water ahead of others.
Some years, there may be enough water to fulfill all our water rights, but that might give a senior the ability to take all the available water in a lean water year.
So that's not like an equal system. If I had my water right before you did, then I get to use all I want, even if there's not enough water for you.
Right, exactly. It's a system where water rights are over-allocated. So it's like selling more parking passes than parking spaces available, except people need water for their livelihoods and for survival. And a point I really want to drive home is that the river itself and the wildlife that depend on that river do not have their own water right. They're not legally entitled to keep any of the water flowing through the river.
So it's better to be a fourth generation rancher like Dean than a millionth generation toad when it comes to water rights.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to summarize it. One exception to that, though, is species listed under the Endangered Species Act. That listing makes it illegal to harm that species. So for grayling, it would mean some water needs to stay in the river, in their habitat, to keep them from going extinct.
All right, so let's bring it back to the Big Hole. There's this year of super intense drought, then ranchers get the news that Arctic grayling may get federal protections. I have to imagine they're not super happy about that.
You know, they weren't happy about that. They were really concerned about what that listing could mean. And landowners in the area started meeting informally, including Dean, the rancher we talked to earlier. His dad, Harold, was there.
As Dad would explain it, the first couple meetings, it was close to blows, you know.
The way Dean describes it, it was a lot of kind of finger pointing at each other, where anglers were saying ranchers were taking too much water. Ranchers were really protective of their livelihoods and their legal right to take water. And then conservationists were trying to speak for the fish themselves, saying they needed a healthy habitat. And so these are all differing interests, but then they realized they all wanted to avoid the same thing. They all wanted to keep Arctic grayling off the endangered species list.
And they come up with this idea that, you know, maybe we can all work together and find a solution for most of the problems.
The solution they came up with was that they decided they needed to share sacrifice to protect the river. Dean says that it was a painstakingly slow process to figure out what that sacrifice would look like, and that required ranchers, anglers, and environmentalists to come together and form the Big Hole Watershed Committee.
What I told my dad originally when I got on the board, I said, the Watershed Committee is just slow moving, nothing happens. And he looks at me and goes, well, what were we talking about when you first started? And I told him, and he said, okay, where were we at in that? And then I realized at that point that, yeah, some of this stuff happens pretty quick. Some of it takes a lot longer. Some of it never happens. But in the end, it's productive.
Something that I think is really interesting, actually, is that Dean wasn't originally part of this committee. His dad, Harold, was, and his dad got older, so Dean would give him a ride to these committee meetings, sat in the back, and heard the kind of discussions they were having, and decided he wanted to join.
But it does take time, and it takes lots of talking and lots of working through issues, and it takes change. I mean, especially nowadays, you've got people on the left and people on the right, and there's not much in the middle that's happening, but that's where all progress is made, is in the middle where you compromise.
So after all that meeting, what kind of compromises did they actually come up with?
Well, there are several pieces to this puzzle of shared sacrifice. Outfitters and guides will give up fishing in the middle of the day when the temperatures are high and the flow of the river is low so that they don't stress out the fish more. Ranchers and landowners will let the Big Hole Watershed Committee come onto their land and help them figure out ways to restore the watershed. So that could look like floodplain restoration or wetlands restoration. And then the big one is water rights holders signing agreements that say they will use less water than they're entitled to protect the river itself. And that has kind of a wonky name. It's the Candidate Conservation Agreement with Assurances.
Wow, that is a wonky name. Let's break that down a little bit. Like, why do ranchers agree to that, and what do they get out of it?
Yeah, I want to make clear that ranchers are not coerced or paid to sign these agreements. It's definitely not mandatory. And this agreement, which is facilitated through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, guarantees that water rights holders who use less water in a lean water year will be protected from legal liability if Arctic grayling are eventually listed under the Endangered Species Act.
So you mean they won't get sued?
Right. So the incentive here is that they won't get sued. And Dean says that's a good incentive, but he also says it's just the quote unquote right thing to do.
And it's not good for me as a rancher to be greedy. You know, it's mine. I'm going to use it. To heck with you. That's a poor attitude. Very poor attitude. Because it's everybody's resource. I don't want to be the rotten apple in the box that ruins it for everybody else, you know.
These agreements make the Big Hole Valley a very unique watershed in Montana. Some of these agreements have been in place since 1995 and were still in place during a historic drought year in 2021.
We'll hear how the Big Hole's model of collaborative conservation held up after a quick break.
Hey, I'm John Adams, editor-in-chief of Montana Free Press. I think so much of our media these days is designed to show us how different we are from one another. One of the things I think is so great about Shared State is the fact that we suss out that nuance. It's not about zero sum. It's not about winners and losers. It's about all of us collectively living in the state together, either moving forward or backward together. If you want to support this kind of journalism, subscribe to the podcast and support the organizations that make this show possible.
We're back with Shared State and Shaylee Rager's story about how anglers, irrigators, and other water users in the Big Hole Valley made a plan in the 1990s to each use a little less water so the river wouldn't run dry again. 30 years later, how's it working?
Well, this model where landowners voluntarily give up some of their water right is still in place, and 34 members total have signed up in the Big Hole Valley, and they even gained a new landowner last summer. And while it is the single most important part of the Big Hole's collaborative conservation, there is other work that the Big Hole Watershed Committee does to supplement those agreements, and that also helps keep water in the river. So I'm going to take you to a different part of the Big Hole Valley now. We are going to Spokane Ranch with experts from Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, the Department of Environmental Quality, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist Jim McGee.
We are in the kind of northwest corner of the upper Big Hole on private lands.
What exactly is this project?
It's a floodplain restoration project. So there's a stream that's running through this ranch, a small tributary of the Big Hole River, that isn't functioning like it should. And so the land isn't holding water like it should.
If it keeps going, it'll dry it up, basically. You'll lose the whole green area. It'll turn into drier species and won't be nearly as productive.
So as you're walking with Jim, tell me, what are you seeing? Like, what is this space?
Well, first, I want you to visualize a really healthy stream. So let's say it's spring. Snow has melted, feeding into this stream. Everything is green and looks really healthy.
So full-on green, lush Montana spring. I got it.
Right. So that's not what's happening at this floodplain. I'm walking with Jim through a cow pasture, and the cows are mooing at us. We're tromping through really crunchy sagebrush, and the ground is really hard. And the way that Jim described it to me is that at some point, maybe even 100 years ago, a man-made structure manipulated the stream. So it could have been a culvert for an irrigation ditch, and that created a change in slope in the stream, forcing the water to run like a fire hose, meaning it leaves the watershed and is not stored there. But the elevation change doesn't impact the entire length of the stream all at once. It slowly moves upstream. So when I went to this project site, we could see the spot where the slope changes. It looks like a little waterfall on the stream, and the stream morphs from a deep ravine where water is flowing like a fire hose to more of a swampy brook with level banks that is forming a healthy floodplain.
Can you tell me what we're looking at?
This is the head cut, so that is the big spring complex up there. If we walked up, see where those willows are? Mm-hmm. That's where it gets healthy. And so this is just degrading and moving up, and if it keeps going, I mean, it'll take a long time, but if it keeps going, it'll dry it all out like this. Yes. So we want to keep the water spread out and keep it green.
So how do you actually do that? How do you keep it green?
Well, their idea is to use an excavator to reroute the stream around this man-made manipulation so that it hopefully returns back to its natural flow.
So kind of like a highway bypass or something, but for this little stream.
Exactly. And it'll be more man-made manipulation to correct original man-made manipulation. But the idea is that the stream will return to its natural function.
So why is the committee working on this? Like, what's their goal?
The goal is to keep more water in the ecosystem. And you can do that by using less water or by holding on to it longer. And that's what this project does. Pedro Marquez is chair of the Big Hole Watershed Committee, and he walked me through the project site.
This is what I was talking about.
Right.
The whole thing is just a spongy, it's like a little earth trampoline. Isn't it? So this is gold as far as like climate goes, right?
Because it's holding water?
Because it's holding water. It's rich, it's dark. That means there's tons of organics, nutrients, right? All the good stuff.
Yeah. Little bubbles. There we go. It really does feel like a waterbed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Pedro says the vision is a landscape like this where water is being held and stored and moving slowly through the watershed. And he says what's really cool about this is that it's a project that benefits both the rancher who is flood irrigating and needs to flood irrigate to make their operation work, and for conservationists who want better water conservation. It's a win-win scenario.
Every little high alpine meadow that we can keep in its sort of maximum wetted sort of functioning hydrology, the better, you know. It's water conserved, it's water in the soil and not on the surface flowing downhill as fast as it can, right? Because the soil is the best tool we have to slow the movement of water out of a landscape.
So one project can help change how the water's behaving in this whole ecosystem?
Well, Pedro says no, but it's still really important.
Don't have any illusions that like the flows of the Big Hole River in August will be noticeably impacted by us doing this work, mm-hmm. But it's like 50 of these projects in this area.
Yeah, I don't know what kind
It's like little, you know, thousand places of improvement is kind of the direction, and it's endless work.
So this work takes a long time. It's expensive. At the same time, you know, the climate is changing quickly, and those impacts are being felt immediately on the ground. How does Pedro maintain that success is possible when you need the kind of scale he envisions?
Do you remember how in 1988 there was a really bad drought and a section of the Big Hole River went dry? Well, we took a short drive to the section of river that went dry just outside of Wisdom, and he showed me why he feels optimistic.
There's a picture of 1988 of this spot right here, bone dry, with no vegetation on the banks. You know?
And so, right now it's pretty full. Well, not maybe.
This is like a base. This is base flow. This is sort of a natural kind of base flow condition here. It's dramatically improved at this spot.
There was less precipitation in 2021 in the Big Hole Valley than there was in 1988 in the same place, but the river didn't go dry. And so Pedro says we know collaborative conservation can work because the river is still flowing. And so far, Arctic grayling haven't been added to the endangered species list. But like you said, it is expensive, it's time-consuming, it depends on grant funding, and a lot of landowner buy-in.
Right, and that buy-in is another potential issue. None of this model is mandatory. You don't have to do any of it if you don't want to.
Exactly. This model depends on human behavior. It depends on consensus. And so some people are asking if this model can continue to be successful as water becomes more scarce and people do a very human thing, which is to take what's theirs. And there are people in the Big Hole Valley who sometimes don't play ball.
And what happens to this whole model of collaborative conservation when you have people who don't play ball?
It puts the whole model on shakier ground and makes it less likely that it'll be successful. Participation can be pretty black and white, in which some landowners sign the agreement and they give up some of their water right. Some landowners don't and they insist on taking their full water right. But it can get more complicated and more convoluted than that.
How so?
So you remember Dean, the rancher that we heard from at the beginning of this episode? He moderates his use of water. And at one point in time, his family's ranch had a candidate conservation agreement to use less water when necessary. But when it came time to re-up that agreement, he didn't want to. He said it would require him to sacrifice more than he thinks is fair.
I guess we felt that we were already given back a lot to the stream, to the watershed, and they were asking us to do a lot more than we felt was comfortable.
Dean is an example of why this is so difficult. He's completely invested in collaborative conservation and water conservation, and yet still, he's not willing to sacrifice all that he's been asked to sacrifice.
So even someone who's really on board with the vision, with keeping more water in the river because it's the right thing to do, has limits about what they personally should do. If that's the case, are there other models for how we can keep things from getting worse and worse as the West gets hotter and drier?
Yeah, Nick, I asked the same question, and that's when I came across Lee Nellis, who is a longtime land use planner. He used to work in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and he now teaches at a college in New York. He actually wrote an article that I came across that said collaborative conservation absolutely has its limits because it isn't enough to stand up to individualistic values that have been upheld in our legal system for as long as we can remember.
When we get to decisions like that where there is an intrinsic value versus a commodity value and there's no open ground, or at least precious little open ground, the collaborative approach just isn't the right approach to that. You have to step up a scale, step up a level and say, okay, there has to be a broader social decision, political decision about what's important here.
Can you give an example of what Lee means?
Yeah, Lee says to look at how indigenous peoples managed the land we live on now pre-colonization.
The Americas is a place where people have lived here for thousands of years. People have used this place for thousands of years.
I spoke with Rosalyn Lapierre about this. She's Blackfeet and Métis and a professor of environmental studies at the University of Montana. She says the biggest misconception is that Native Americans were simply hunters and gatherers and not land managers.
it's not just that people were kind of using the landscape as it existed. They were actually changing the landscape. They were changing it in a lot of different ways and managing it so that it was of benefit not only to them, but also to the natural world.
A great example of this type of natural resource management is how the Blackfeet tribe valued and protected beaver. So beavers provide a really important function in creating water storage with their dams in watersheds. And that was lost when colonizers commodified beavers for the fur trade. And to this day, there is a huge effort across North America to mimic that kind of work that beavers do naturally that we don't see as often anymore.
Indigenous people, for the most part, did not have to deal with things such as like starvation or want. In fact, they had the opposite, which is they had not only kind of the abundance of being able to take care of themselves, but they also were able to collect surplus.
So it sounds like one of the ideas Rosalind's getting at is this notion of valuing the natural world for what it already offers.
Right. Lee Nellis, that land use planner, says we've lost that intrinsic value. He says that as a society, post-colonization, we have commodified all of our natural resources, and that until we change how we value those resources, collaborative conservation will just be a band-aid. And the evidence he uses is that the collective value system we have right now says we can run a river dry. So while that's really philosophical, the tangible translation here is how our value systems translate into laws and regulation. There are Montana lawmakers who have tried to create laws that require water to stay in rivers, that say landowners can't run rivers dry, that give rivers their own water rights. And those proposals have always been dead on arrival because it would upend the system we have now.
Right. So Lee's calling for this big society-wide shift that could create laws and policy and regulation. What do folks like Dean, you know, people who are using water on the ground, think of ideas like that?
Dean and other landowners in the Big Hole really don't think that regulation is a good idea. Dean says that people don't like being told what to do, that it will change a system that they've operated under since Manifest Destiny brought people out to the West. And he says it's not even feasible to change the current system.
I think in the minds of some people, a regulation to have an in-stream flow guarantees more water. But what I'm hearing you're saying is that isn't the truth, that collaboration is a better guarantee?
Well, it's a better route to take. I mean, if you have an in-stream flow, you're guaranteed whatever that is. But if you're talking the Big Hole River, where do you go get that? Where are you gonna get it? Are you gonna get a little bit from everyone? How are you gonna do this, you know? It's just an added cost for everybody, more regulation and less cooperation. Everybody becomes more greedy at that point, including me.
I originally went to the Big Hole Valley because experts told me there is a model there that is very successful and the gold standard for water conservation. And what I found is a model that's working in spite of the system it's operating within. So the question from here is, can other collaborative conservation models work, or will climate change push us to systemic change in the future? Montana will be updating its state drought management plan for the first time since 1995 over the next year. And I think that document is really going to show us how Montana plans to share this resource into the future.
Shared State is a podcast by Montana Free Press, Montana Public Radio, and Yellowstone Public Radio. This episode was reported by Shaylee Rager and edited by Nikki Ouellette. I'm your host, Nick Mott. Mara Silvers produced this episode. Editorial assistance by Corin Cates Carney, Nadia Foe, and Brad Tyre. Fact-checking by Jess Sheldahl, and Gabe Sweeney is our sound designer.